Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, Assistant Professor of Communication and Media at Lund University. Remember, you can follow the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web at socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in and apologies for not getting more pods out to you in the past few weeks. It's been busy times with the end of the academic semester here in Sweden. So if I drop off every now and then, it's for good reason, I assure you. But coming up, we'll have the 2022 Year in Review episode with Dr. Anna Maria Ducek-Segesten, seventh annual, I believe. And I'm going to try to record some podcasts in December so that there'll be more of a steady stream of content in January. But on to the topic of today's show, with my guest, Professor Bruce Mutsvairo. He is a professor of media and politics at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, and he is an expert in the intersection of journalism, media, and democracy, particularly citizen journalism and digital and data dissidence and activism in the global south. So Professor Mutsvairo is an expert in social media, politics, and journalism in African countries. I understand that to say the African context is a bit generalist. There's 54 different countries in different phases of democratic transition. This is something we'll talk about in the episode. But Professor Mutsvairo has done field work in countries like Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Mali, and Ethiopia. And we'll discuss his findings from some of that research. In particular, what I wanted to focus on is generally, sort of what's the deal with social media and politics in Africa? And in particular, I'm curious to hear more about things like data bundles, which is something I recently learned about, where mobile data is expensive in African countries, also in parts of the Middle East. So what providers do is they say you can buy a certain amount of data, let's say 200 megabytes. And then while you have this plan, you could use one platform for free. And that's the platform you decide to bundle with. So you might have unlimited access to WhatsApp or Facebook. That doesn't count against your data limit. And so I'm wondering kind of what effect does that have for how social media is used generally, but also how it's used for politics in particular. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about citizen journalism, which is one of Professor Mutsvairo's areas of expertise. And that is basically the idea that citizens who are not trained journalists can report news through technologies like the smartphone and also post them to social media. And we'll also talk about, interestingly, the role of influencers becoming citizen journalists in different African countries, which is something that Professor Mutsvairo is actively doing research on. Now, before I cut to the interview, I need to make a clarifying statement that, ironically, as we were discussing African governments shutting down access to the internet, Professor Mutsvairo's internet dropped, even though he's in Utrecht. But apparently there are people who are working on his internet infrastructure. And so we had to switch to a phone call. Obviously, the audio quality is going to take a bit of a hit there. But I'd encourage you to push through, because that's where we start talking about this really interesting phenomenon of influencers being paid to promote either pro-government narratives or the narratives of the political opposition. And that can be fake news or disinformation. And that's something that's accelerated over the course of the coronavirus pandemic, which in a sense requires us to rethink what is citizen journalism today. Does that count as a form of citizen journalism, or is that something else? So in that spirit, Professor Mutsvairo is putting together a special issue on citizen journalism revisited. I promised him to share the call for that special issue, and you'll find a link to it, as well as a couple of Professor Mutsvairo's papers down in the episode description. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Professor Bruce Mutsvairo. Again, he is a professor of media and politics at Utrecht University. Professor Mutsvairo, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we hop right into theory here and discuss what you've called the Janus face of social media, that it's a tool for democratization on the one hand, but also for oppression and misrepresentation on the other. So can you unpack this Janus-faced role of social media for us? And how might it be particularly important to look at both sides when thinking about social media in an African context?
Thanks so much, Mike. I think what we were just trying to say with that is really to try and show how social media can be a double-edged sword, particularly when it comes to the African context. That is to say that on one hand, it can be used by activists and people who are fighting for democratic emancipation, if you want to call it that way. But at the same time, it comes with a lot of challenges, which I guess are not just confined to the African continent, but as we are also seeing across the world, you know, the polarization, the disinformation, the fake news, but also particularly in the African continent, the fact that, the leaders also have access to the social media platforms. So they will also try to use them to surveil activists, for example. They will also try to use these platforms to their own advantage. So it is not maybe what we originally thought perhaps would lead to the political emancipation of citizens, perhaps around 2010 was it when we were talking about the Arab Spring and everybody was so excited. It became a bubble that, the global South, the entire global South would suddenly become politically independent, or activists were now weaponized to fight against tyranny. I mean, obviously, we have had tiny pockets of that, but I think for the rest, everything has stayed the same. So, I mean, in short, it's just to show that social media isn't the best game in town, if you want to call it like that. It also comes with a heavy price to pay for those who are using these platforms to change seeking change, rather.
Yeah, and I want to kind of return to those themes as we move through the episode, but I wanted to kind of focus a bit more on the political context across the African continent, because there's different levels of democratization in the 54 countries in Africa. And in one of the articles I was reading that you wrote, you mentioned that some countries are hybrid regimes, such as Uganda, Tanzania, and Mozambique. So I wanted to ask, what is a hybrid regime, and how might the role of social media sort of change based on whether this regime is hybrid or not?
Well, there are different variations of hybrid regimes, or at least different scholars have come up with different perspectives in describing them. But in my opinion, it simply shows you have got a political system such as those of Uganda, where on one hand, you have a president who has been there since the 80s, has been there for quite a long time, is essentially a little bit of what some people would probably consider to be slightly democratic. So, for example, it's not always every journalist who is always going to be arrested and put in prison if he criticizes the government. So there is a little bit of some freedoms that people can see, but at the same time, it's not really wholesale democratic. So there are also still a lot of political disturbances, but they're hybrid because they also seek to show that, you know, we are not as bad as everybody else thinks we are. But if you really look at it from a very critical perspective, then you actually see that, you know, it's very piecemeal. You know, it's most of those changes or the democratic changes that they talk of are just meant to, deceive the world. But I guess it also speaks to their histories, to their locations, you know, the context where they operate from. Of course, there's a lot of opposition, but it's quite protracted in the sense that they also have a lot of support. I mean, if you try to look at it from a Western perspective, you would be wondering, like, how could somebody be in power since, like, the president of Cameroon, Paul Biya, since 1980? How is that possible? Or Equatorial Guinea, I think the president there, President Nguema, has been in power since 1979. How can that be? It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Yet, of course, most of the elections that are held in these countries are always questionable. I think the last election in Equatorial Guinea, the president won something like 97% or something like that, you know, which is unimaginable. But, you know, it only happens there. But still, you also really see that in spite of all the tactics that they may actually use to prolong their political power, political presence, there is also some people who support them. You know, they are not hated by everybody. And of course, you could also argue that there are many reasons for that, including propaganda, you know, which is quite used effectively, and perhaps the literacy rate might be very low in some of these countries. You know, it's very difficult because, of course, every country is different from the other. But yeah, they are really able to survive because on one hand, they can earn some support from a group of people, or they can try to show a little bit of some democratic credentials. But on the whole, you actually see that, you know, the entire system is quite rotten, and you know, it's just deceiving everybody, and but it's enough for them to stay in power.
Yeah, it's interesting you're mentioning these leaders who've been in power for like 50 years. So it doesn't seem that social media is necessarily like changing the game for like overthrowing these leaders, or that they're, you know, surviving on digital propaganda because they were leaders before social media. So I'm just curious to get your thoughts on, you know, what are the sort of reasons that we haven't seen this type of Arab Spring democratization that was so popular in the 2010s?
Right. I think one of my colleagues, Teje Skendal from Norway, actually wrote an article explaining why the Arab Spring never came to Ethiopia. I mean, he's an expert on Ethiopia. It's quite interesting. There are several factors which make it very difficult, you know, for digital platforms or any form of technology to be used effectively to remove these leaders, because they are so severely, or at least they use their power so forceful on people to the extent that it is almost impossible, you know, to organize and overthrow them. I mean, there are instances, of course, where social media has been used, or you could argue that to some extent it played a massive role in the overthrowing of the president, Sudan. Omar al-Bashir, who ironically actually said before, I think a year or so before, he actually laughed at activists and said, you know, he would never be, or social media would never be used to actually overthrow him. And that's exactly, I think, what happened, or at least it played a bit of some role there in removing him, because, you know, people were able, particularly young people, were able to organize themselves and revolt. But what is always the biggest problem in most of these countries is the fact that the connection between the offline and the online is not always there. I think in most cases, for example, I think Sudan is a good example, there was a lot of activity online which was then transferred offline. And in many countries which have tried to overthrow their political elites or leaders, it has always been difficult, because what is online is simply not possible to bring it to the offline environment. So in that sense, it becomes really hard. I think there's also a big role to play in terms of the Chinese involvement. The Chinese technologies are being used in many African countries. There's a lot of research on that. That actually shows the power that these technologies, which are being used for the purposes of surveillance, to identify the activists, what the government would call the culprits, and it's working in the favor of some of these leaders, certainly, because of course they simply have to know who is behind these protests, and then they just throw them in a cell for a long time. And so that's a way to try and dissuade dissent, be it online and offline. So identifying the leaders. And you also see that most of these people then sort of flee from their countries and they go in the diaspora. And I guess from afar, it becomes really difficult. Again, it's that online and offline. There are a lot of diasporic communities that are very active in trying to bring political transformations in their home countries. But it's very hard from a distance, I guess, because they're very vibrant online and there's a lot of information that people actually also will be having, you know, in terms of accurate, truthful information. But at the same time, they are not always seen as a problem by the regime, because the regimes, most of these, they use the police, they use the army to try and dissuade dissent. So yeah, this is really the reality. And I mean, these platforms, they could play a role, but I think it is going to take a lot of time, as we have also seen in the Arab Spring, how difficult it has been since the overthrow of, say, the presidents of Libya or Tunisia and Egypt, and what has also happened after that. So it's not always that easy, you know, that, you know, you could have a leader being overthrown, as we have seen in the Arab world. There are always going to be a lot of problems after the leader has been overthrown.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting to keep in mind, like you're saying about the diasporas, that they may be active online, but it's hard to translate sometimes from afar into these offline activism contexts. So I wanted to ask you about something I was reading in terms of these social media taxes, or sort of taxes on the internet, that we've seen, for example, in Uganda, that was then sort of later repealed. And so I'm just wondering if you know anything about these taxes, and if you can sort of describe maybe why they're sometimes present in African contexts, but we haven't seen something similar in the US or EU.
Well, I think it's just a ploy from the side of the government, you know, to try and stop dissent. It's, of course, you know, in many countries, I mean, we can talk of the digital divide as one of the major issues, and of course, access and all other issues are getting a little bit better on the African continent, as, you know, compared to the situation, say, a few years back. But what you see with these taxes is just they are all meant to try and discourage the use of social media, because it's very expensive. You know, one of the poorest countries in the world, Malawi, internet is probably one of the most expensive in the world, you know, just internet access, buying internet. So if you think about it, if you're asking to pay more for you to be able to access internet, then, you know, obviously, everybody wants to first put food on the table, or, you know, there are other things to look at that are maybe more important than internet. So because of that, I think, particularly in the Ugandan case, the main aim was just to try and discourage people from participating, because they will be charging them. But I think they also realized it was really going to be very difficult to try and force everybody to pay. And I haven't read recently about what has happened, but the friends and colleagues who worked there initially when this was introduced, you know, talking to them, they were all just saying, like, ah, this is a waste of time, because how are they going to actually force people from paying? And these are all tactics that governments introduce, as I said, to try and ensure that, you know, the opposition parties, the people who are fighting for democratic change, are not allowed to get their voices across. Because, of course, these leaders are not stupid. They are there. They stay there in power for a long time just because, you know, they try to outsmart everybody. And they realize that social media has the potential to be a game changer. So, you know, they tax, but taxing is not the only sort of tactic. One of the major tactics that we've seen on the African continent has been the internet shutdowns, you know. They simply switch it off, so that when people are trying to organize themselves for protests, then internet is down. It has happened in many countries. You could talk of dozen African.
Hey, man.
Hey, Bruce. Ironic that we're talking about the internet shutting down.
We chose the wrong dates, but yeah, anyway, it is what it is now. I was talking about the internet shutdowns, you know, being really a major issue now. Many governments, you could have at least 20 African countries that have been doing this for the last 5 or so years. Whenever there is a get-together, or if there are any protests that are being organized, the government simply switches off to try and stop this sort of sporadic, organized protest. Because, of course, communication, they realize that communication is a very important weapon for these activists to organize themselves. So this has then become also a real major tactic or weapon that's being used by African leaders. And it doesn't surprise me that, you know, some of these leaders can and will stay in power for a long time, because these tactics have indeed been proven to work. Because, you know, if the internet is down, then it's very difficult for people to organize themselves or to know where to go to protest. So, yeah, it's very effective.
Yeah, and I want to switch over to citizen journalism in a second, but I did have a question about these kind of data infrastructures. And this is something I recently learned about in Zimbabwe, but I know it's in other African countries and Middle Eastern countries as well, which is the idea of these data bundles, where when you purchase a data plan, let's say you buy 200 megabytes, then you bundle it up with a certain platform like WhatsApp, Facebook, or Instagram, and then you can use that platform for free, not counting towards your data, but then you have the data that you bought on top. And so I'm just wondering how that model sort of works and if that has any implications for, you know, when we think about people using platforms in the West, they're using them for different purposes, you know, communicating with friends on WhatsApp versus information on Twitter. But I think that data bundle model may have some more serious implications for political activism, for example. So what are your thoughts on those?
Well, this is quite interesting. And I think for a lot of people in Africa, you know, the issues that we probably write about, particularly, you know, issues like data, you know, access to data and all these concerns about people's data, the debate on the African continent is still very much elite-oriented, that kind of debate. I mean, there are, of course, people talking about that and very worried about that. But, you know, if you look at it from the perspective of somebody who is just trying to put his or her message across, they look at those available tariffs or, you know, bundles that are offered by telecom companies, and they're cheap. For them, they're cheap. That's what they think about first. They're affordable. So if and when they can use them, they are willing to use them, even at the expense of them having to actually put their data online. Because I think there's debate, less education about data on the African continent. It's growing. Clearly, you actually see it like that. But I guess citizens are not as well informed about the dangers of subscribing to these platform initiatives in terms of surveillance, potential surveillance of activists. I mean, not everybody is aware of that, because people will just do it, perhaps simply because it's affordable and they can afford it, particularly if they are not being funded by an NGO or somebody else, because they would be looking at the fact that, oh, they have access to internet, they can communicate their ideas. But of course, it can also be quite more sophisticated. And that is, if you look at people who have access and who have access to knowledge and experiences, who protect themselves, and who are trying to use different platforms, you know, who try to avoid WhatsApp and try to think of maybe other platforms which they may consider to be maybe a bit more safer than WhatsApp. It is actually happening right now. It's being used by these activists.
You mean that they're giving out these bundles, or?
Well, I mean more like information. Instead of using WhatsApp, for example, then they use Telegram, for example, you know, because they find it a little bit more safer and secure than WhatsApp. But in terms of just, you know, the bundles are available. And I think the easiest way to look at them is many people are using them simply because data is expensive, perhaps more expensive than anywhere else, you know, very, very expensive. So when bundles come in, when they say if you buy for $1 or $2, then you can use WhatsApp for free. And then maybe you're going to have 100 minutes for calling that are available for you. These sort of bundles, they are attractive to a lot of people simply because data itself is expensive. I think in many countries, we have had a lot of protests. Like, for example, in South Africa, there was hashtag data must fall, which became quite big because it's not affordable for people to use data. So these packages, they see them as sort of a godsend, if you want to look at it like that, because it enables them to participate just like anybody else.
Mm. And I suppose that makes it, it's a bit of a different dynamic than just having, you know, an option of 8 or 10 different social media to fulfill a different political purpose. I think it makes studying it.
Exactly.
It makes studying it very hard. I wanted to ask you, you know, one of the areas that you've been focusing on in your research is citizen journalism. And I'm wondering if you could describe a bit what exactly citizen journalism is for our listeners who may not be familiar with it. And then in particular, how has that concept developed over time in the African context?
So, yeah, thanks for asking that. With two colleagues, we actually have a special issue that may be at the times, maybe today or tomorrow, which we are simply calling citizen journalism revisited. That's just because we see that there's a little bit of not just on the research side, but also, the term, the use of the term, the use of, citizen journalism seems to have taken a little bit of a nosedive, the interest both in researchers, but also as far as practitioners are concerned. So yeah, we want to look at how things are in different contexts, both Western and non-Western societies. But to answer your question, citizen journalism is simply people who are not trained as journalists, arming themselves with technologies such as cell phones and doing the reporting, the editing, and the sharing of information themselves. And, the advantages are, of course, the fact that they are much closer to what's happening. In many cases, you actually see even traditional, including here in the West, traditional media outlets using amateur footages that have been shot by people who are not activists because they live in the communities where things are happening. And it always takes a longer time to get a professional journalist to get there. So, yeah, that's where the concept really, really stems from. And there are a lot of scholars who have worked on this. I can think of two of my favorites, Stuart Allen and Melissa Wall. They have really done a lot of work, others as well. But what it is simply non-professional, non-trained people arming themselves or taking the technologies and doing the reporting themselves rather than sending it to CNN or BBC or waiting for CNN, BBC to disseminate. Then they simply do it themselves. And it, of course, plays a central role, particularly in countries where freedom of expression is not allowed or is tampered with, simply because in most of those countries, people only get the news that the state has sanctioned. So it's very much pro-state. It's pretty much propaganda, But citizen journalism allows an alternative voice, allows an alternative perspective that might be lacking. And it's very much difficult to control for the state because these people are not always known. They are not always citizen journalists. In many African countries, what you are really seeing now is that role has been adopted by influencers. So influencers, people who have, 500,000 followers, sometimes they are very young. The two countries I'm working with colleagues in Mali and Ethiopia to try and see, what role disinformation, social media plays in worsening or potentially worsening conflict. And what you see in these countries is, of course, the fact that many of these young people, most of them with no perspective of life, abandoned by the state, they understand the online sphere more than anyone else. And, of course, they have a lot of followers. And they are the spreaders of the news, but also of the fake news, which is, of course, a challenge for citizen journalism. One of the main sort of critiques that has been leveled against citizen journalism for a long time is the fact that the people are not trained, so they are not ethical. They don't understand the ethics of journalism, and they just do it as they want it. And of course, you really see that argument, I think, in many of these cases, because sometimes they get paid. So political opponents or political people, powerful people, elites, they will give some money to these youth and say, go and put this on your website or on your social media platform so that it can spread. But, they have no option. If they are going to get money, they will do it for the sake of money. But ethically, of course, there are problems associated with that. So, yeah, that's citizen journalism for you. And it's quite interesting and it's moving. It's really moving to include new actors, as we are seeing now in Africa.
Yeah, we'll definitely advertise the special issue call in the episode description. So best of luck with putting that together. But that's really interesting. So I haven't actually thought so much about the kind of negative side of citizen journalism. And I was going to ask you exactly about what are the motives for these young influencers in Mali and in Ethiopia. Is it really that they're being sort of paid to, is it just to promote positive information about the government and make it look like it's coming from them authentically? Or kind of what are the dynamics there that you've been seeing?
So it's quite interesting because, you know, some of them, they are just, it's like political prostitution. They are open to anybody, you know. They open up to the highest bidder. Whoever is willing to pay, whoever is going to give them money, they are going to advertise. What they have, which many people don't have, is these followers, you know. So immediately, if any information that they advertise or it's, you know, if they put it on their website, then a lot of people are adopting or are commenting. That is maybe what the political elites want. So the problem is, in this case, not all of these people or actors or players have got this sort of ethical dimension where they say, well, before I advertise or before I take money, I'm going to first look to see how credible the information that I'm putting out is, you know. They just simply open up to anybody who is willing to pay them. And, you know, on one end, we could talk about ethics and say, well, obviously, this does not make any sense. Why would somebody do that? But these people are poverty-stricken. They have no other option, you know. This is their way of surviving, you know. It's power, having a lot of people following you, as we have noticed also in the West. It's a very powerful thing. You are very powerful if you are having a lot of followers. So I think that is what is happening in this. But it happens at the expense of spreading rumors, spreading disinformation, and of course, sometimes exacerbating the conflict. Because then, you know, people will get information that is not always correct, and then they just think it is. They take it the way it is. So this is a really, it is a major challenge. And, you know, to be honest, I don't know if I can call this citizen journalism, but these are the questions that we want to ask, because citizen journalism is having a different shape. It's taking different twists, different meanings right now, I think, in the 21st century. Because in this case, like the influencers, I don't think they even see themselves as citizen journalists. Like in the case of Mali, for example, what we see is journalists themselves, upon realizing also that, you know, they are losing out to these players, they are now becoming also influencers. Because they realize it is easier to get their message across being online and being influencers than being seen as a journalist, as a conventional journalist. So, you know, newspapers, one of their main sources has become these platforms, because that's what they use. That's where they get the information. So, yeah, they are citizen journalists, but they are also kind of journalists in a way. I mean, depending on how you want to define or what, who you want to call a journalist. And that's the debate that we are hoping we can try to bring with this special issue that I was talking about.
Yeah, I'm thinking about in the, you know, we've talked a little bit about influencers and political campaigns on this show. And the idea there is that the influencers are very protective of the candidates that they would support because it kind of has to fit their values or their brand. Where I think in the cases you're looking at, it's like they're willing to take any political opinion or brand in order to make money, which is a kind of interesting structural difference there. But my last question for you has to do with the coronavirus pandemic. And I know that you've been looking a bit into this in your research as well. And, you know, we often talk about the pandemic accelerating already existing changes like transitions to remote work or the gig economy. But do you have any insights to share on what effects the pandemic might have had when it comes to social media and politics or journalism in the cases you've been studying?
Yes, in fact, with a colleague, we just wrote a piece about that, actually. I mean, there were also problems, I think, in the West, but it was even worse for many of our colleagues in non-Western societies. COVID-19 was something, obviously, that was new to a lot of people, and it was used as a tool to stop political campaigning, political activism, but also not just that, but also journalism. In some cases, journalists were just arrested and they lost their freedom to move because of these stiff lockdowns. You know, there were a lot of lockdowns, and during the lockdowns, journalists would not be allowed to move around. And the situation was really terrible in many countries, say in Africa, for example, as much as I know, because they couldn't do their work anymore. Because also activists were simply told to stay at home. It simply meant that it was difficult for them to operate, but it was also really a thorn in their flesh as far as doing their work was contained, because all they could do was just to stay at home. And many governments used the coronavirus as an excuse to stop anybody who was critical to their political activities. So to them, it was really a wonderful opportunity, you know, because suddenly they had the COVID-19, which went on for, you know, I mean, still not gone now. I think the problems are not completely gone, as we know. But it was really a nice opportunity to get their political opponents to stay at home. And it gave them time, you know, to think. And in some cases, some of the political opponents, they also died, you know, during the COVID-19 situation. So it was terrible. For some political players in Africa, it was really great because it gave them that potential or that time to rethink, to reorganize, because most of their opponents could not or did not have the freedom to move around and organize themselves.
And I'm kind of tying this all together. I'm wondering if maybe that contributes to having more power in the hands of these influencers you were talking about, because journalists can't go out in the field and report.
Exactly. And no question about that. I mean, we still would have to look for more empirical evidence, but I can already see it. You know, it's not going to be difficult to find that kind of data supporting such perspectives, simply because, you know, everything that was available was online. So if you wanted to get something across, a message across, you needed somebody to do it for you. And these influencers became the only operators, and they became very popular, of course, around that time, because that was the only form of entertainment, the only form of news, the only form of, I don't know, information. That if you wanted anything, you had to really be connected online, because that's where everything was happening. And certainly, and I think there's a lot of research that has been done to actually show and prove that as well. So yes, enormously, I think many people that were not known before the COVID pandemic, they became popular. After the pandemic, they became celebrities because it gave them the opportunity to sell themselves to the people.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I think when reading your research and having this conversation, I think about these structures like the data bundles, or what are the effects of journalism of the pandemic and the ties between the state and some of these influencers. It helps me put into context things that are happening also in the cases that I'm studying. So I hope our listeners got some value out of it as well. So Professor Mutsvairo, thanks so much for taking the time out and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you, sir. It was really an honor to be invited.
I've just been speaking with Professor Bruce Mutsvairo, Professor of Media and Politics at Utrecht University. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Next time, we'll have the 2022 Social Media and Politics Year in Review, and thereafter, an interview with Megan Clayson, partner at Gambit Strategies. But until then, I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Malmö. See you next time.